Okay, you've got a new book coming out, so let's talk about that a little bit. What, a practical?
Yes, let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I have kids. They need to go to college. Let's talk about that.
And you can pre-order it on Amazon, and I've already done that.
Thank you.
But A Practical Guide to Culture, Helping the Next Generation Navigate Today's World. If there's one deep, heartfelt concern, I think of everyone in this room and that we hear over and over again, is how do we reach our young people? And so when you say next, I mean, speak to that a little bit, but let me first define next generation. Are you saying minors under 18? Are you saying millennials too? Or just in, you know, what's your advice on how we raise up this next generation?
My co-author is Brett Kunkel. He and I really aim this at parents, mentors, teachers, anyone concerned about, you know, students. Okay, so let's say, you know, college students and below. But my interest really is, you know, the Colson Center has been completely lock-focused from, and we inherited this from Chuck, on this idea of Christians are supposed to engage the culture. The best way to engage the culture is to engage the next generation, because culture flips every generation. Not completely, right? But do you realize that all of you have a smartphone, or just about all of you have a smartphone, but that's less than 15 years old as a reality. Smartphones have completely changed culture in some very tangible ways, economic ways. No one knows how to use a map anymore, for example, right? I mean, you could just go down the list. That's not that long ago. And so when we, in a sense, we're also trying to call parents, grandparents, pastors, and so on, business leaders, to look after the next generation. If you really care about the future, right, you got to care about the next generation. We saw this, by the way, on the same-sex marriage issue, which was also, by the way, one of the impetus behind writing this book. But on the same-sex marriage issue, do you remember when we had so many marriage amendments passed in state after state after
30?
State? 30 to nothing. And there was this moment on Larry King Live where Larry King was asking a gay activist who was on his program, and I think at this point it was like 21 to nothing. It's like, you know, 21 straight state legislatures have passed a marriage amendment defining marriages between a man and a woman. You're losing 21 to nothing. Are you discouraged? And his response was, not at all. Because Will and Grace is the number one show on television. You see what he realized, right? That laws are downstream from culture. Politics tends to be, not always, but mostly is downstream from culture, right? And so we can have all the laws we want on the books right now if we don't have the hearts and minds of the next generation. And I mean just the Christian kids in the next generation, right? Then we're in for a world of hurt. And also, obviously, we should care about them because we love them, right? And if you love them, you should care about the ideas that take them captive. So that really was the drive behind it.
Okay, so similar that you mentioned Will and Grace. You're a father of three daughters.
Yes.
And a son on the way, correct?
Yes, I do. So, you know, there's a parable that Jesus tells about the persistent widow. Do you know that parable? Where the widow just goes every day to the judge, and finally the judge is like, all right, those are my three daughters, right? So my daughters are 11, 9, and 7, and for 5 years they've been praying for a little brother, and they're getting one in May, so we're excited. But yeah. Okay.
So the controversy of the day on Facebook, if you haven't seen this yet, is Beauty and the Beast. So what are you doing with your three daughters and Beauty? And I mean, I remember you talking about Frozen and how much you had to hear the Frozen song. So now it's going to be Beauty and the Beast. What are you doing about that gay character, and how are you handling that with your daughters? And advice.
Well, thanks for asking. I had we also do, in addition to Breakpoint, which is the daily thing, we do a thing called The Point, which is a 1 minute, and it's also on about half the radio stations, and we also use it on social media. So yesterday's Point was about this, and it got me in a lot of trouble, right? A lot of trouble. And the backdrop, obviously, is, first of all, you have to understand if you have daughters or granddaughters, they've known about this remake, this real-life remake of Beauty and the Beast for about a year now. Is that right? Anybody else in that situation where you have a daughter? I mean, just been talking about it. Well, an announcement was made a couple weeks ago that there was going to be a gay moment in Beauty and the Beast. Did anybody see this story? That there's going to be a gay moment. Now, that could mean almost anything. Almost always what that means is that a movie, some company, in this case Disney, is trying to throw a bone to the HRC, the Human Rights Campaign. They're trying to get some brownie points with the audience, right? That's what they're trying to do, almost always. And almost always, because this isn't the first time. There was something in, like, How to Train Your Dragon 2, and there was also something in another film that was kind of like a gay moment. That was Pixar, but, or not Pixar, but the other one. But anyway, almost always it's a blink and you might miss it sort of thing, right? Introduced. But this is Beauty and the Beast. This is not How to Train Your Dragon 2. This will be one of the biggest movies of all time, right? This is the real-life remake of Beauty and the Beast has been highly anticipated now for a year. It's got Emma Watson from Harry Potter fame. This is not going to be a small thing. This is going to be a huge thing. And so immediately there was a call to boycott. There was a call to do that. I have mixed feelings about boycotts. They sometimes work. They most often don't. And there's also the reality of, well, what do we mean by gay moment? Is this a gay moment like, is this going to be like huge or is this going to be... Not at all. I mean, is it going to be a blink and you miss it and they're just patting themselves on the back in order to get the HRC's kind of brownie points? And that's a good question. No one knows. Here's the other interesting thing about the gay moment is that you might, if you know the cartoon version of Beauty and the Beast, you might know which character it is. It's the one that, how many of you guys know Beauty? I have three daughters. I live in this, everything in my house has one of those stupid princesses on it. I mean, you guys know Beauty and the Beast in the story, and you've seen it. Okay, so there's Gaston, right? The arrogant guy that wants to... And then he's got that little friend, right? Right, Le Fou. He's going to have the gay moment in the real-life Le Fou. Here's interesting, though, and no one's actually brought this up except one of our writers who's smarter than everybody that I've ever met, that you know what Le Fou means in French? Yeah, it's the fool. I'm just going to let that sit, and you guys decide. I don't know if this is a win or not, you know. And there's always these lines of how soon is too soon, you know, and all that sort of stuff. What I posted is, it was that, look, there's calls to boycott. What I'm going to do, it's probably going to be a moment that if you blink, you miss it. What I'm going to do is I'm not going to let my daughters blink and miss it. We'll watch it, and then I'm going to point it out, and then we're going to have a conversation about it. Because it's not going to be anything explicit. There's not going to be any sexuality. It's going to be an attraction and kind of a goofy in love stuff. Because, A, that's what we do with almost all of our movies and all of our shows and all the commercials. When a moment pops up, whether we like it or not, we stop and we have a conversation. And the main reason is we live, as we say in the book, in the age of information, where... kids on a daily basis get bombarded with more information than any other generation in history, right? Our kids encounter more information in a daily basis today than a kid who lived in the 1200s would have seen his entire life. And so one of the most important tools that kids need is the ability to spot, it's what Nancy Piercy calls a baloney detector, to spot nonsense or to spot wrong or evil when they see it. And also, I live in Colorado. I mean, Colorado Springs is a very divided place. You have everyone who loves Focus on the Family and everyone who hates Focus on the Family. And there's nobody in the middle in Colorado Springs. And so you walk down the street, we're going to have gay moments on the street. We've had gay moments on airplanes as we've flown back and forth across the country. Have you noticed the gay moments in commercials have been noticeably more? And so our approach is going to be... Now, would that be my approach with... You know, am I saying that's how everyone should do it? No. Would that be my approach if my kids were 4 or 5? No. They're 11, 9, and 7. And this isn't the first time we had that conversation either. When the Obergefell decision came out from the Supreme Court, my wife and I talked about it. Came out on Friday. Remember that? On Sunday night, we sat down with our daughters, and I said, "Hey, we need to tell you about something that happened in our nation today." Is that our, you know, governments don't always make a great decision. And the Supreme Court actually decided that something was legal that actually doesn't exist. And here's what they decided. And here's what Jesus said about it in Matthew 19. And my middle daughter was like, "What? No one would ever do that." And I said, no, people have done that. People have decided that two men and two women, or, you know, or that they wanted to marry another man or another woman. And here's why, and here's what's behind it. And I didn't plan to have a conversation about same-sex marriage with my 10-year-old, 8-year-old, and 6-year-old. But I wanted to have the conversation with them before somebody else did. So anyway, all that to say, not everyone agreed with me on Facebook. Probably not everyone agrees with me in this room. It was a pretty heated discussion on Facebook last night. But that's all right. I also completely understand those who feel like their kids are not ready for that moment, or they don't feel equipped to have that conversation with their kids about that moment. And if that's the case, two things. I get it. Don't go. And number two, get equipped to have a conversation with your kids about that moment. We all at least need to agree on that. If we don't have the conversation with our kids about identity, about sexuality, one of the things we talk about, sorry, I'm rambling, but one of the things we talk about in the book is in section 2 and section 3 are different. Section 3 is what we call the pounding waves of culture. These are the ones we feel, right? Like where you're at a beach and then a wave hits you and another wave hits you, right? You know, same-sex marriage, racial tension, pornography, Twitter and Facebook and social media, right? Transgenderism. These are the individual issues. And in our new book, we have about 14 chapters on 14 different issues that are just pounding us, and how to think about them, and how to talk to them with your kids. But that chapter, that section 3 are those 14. Section 2 are what we call undercurrents, right? C.S. Lewis said that the most dangerous ideas in a society aren't the ones that are argued, but the ones that are assumed, the ones that go unnoticed. Does that make sense? Beauty and the Beast is not going to steal your kids. You know, a gay moment of Beauty and the Beast is not going to steal your kids' hearts. What's going to steal their hearts is the undercurrent in which identity in our culture is assumed to be self-determined. Does that make any sense? We think identity is self-constructed and self-created. We think we are something by the mere fact that I asserted that I am something. We think that, you know, like for example, when it comes to words like parents or sexual partners or male and female, on those three things, on those three issues of identity, sexual partners, male and female, and parents, we think that genitalia is suddenly irrelevant to that conversation. That we can say what we are as if we don't have any parts, right? This is like saying gravity doesn't exist. Does that make sense? So my point here is what's going to get our kids are these unseen undercurrents that are just completely redefining a word that's so important, like identity. What does it mean to be human? Right? Who are we? And so the transgenderism issue and the LGBT, all the other LGBT issues are expressions of that, right? So anyway, got me in a lot of trouble.
Okay, so related to that, we have a bright intern at Center for Arizona Policy, Kayleen Swift, who's a student at Grand Canyon, and I'd ask our interns if they had questions, and Kayleen had a question that I think is somewhat, you're talking about how we work with our kids. Kayleen's question goes more to how we as Christians go out in the public. Kayleen, do you have the microphone, or can somebody give her the microphone and have Kayleen ask her question?
My question was, as Christians, we face so many controversial issues that pertain so much to our faith. How, as Christians, are we supposed to take on these issues and look different to the world so that they actually listen to our argument instead of just blow it out of proportion?
Yeah, that's a great question. And by the way, my nephew's going to Grand Canyon next year. So anyway, is it a good school?
Yes.
Okay, that's good to know. That's a great question. And there's a lot of different layers to that. I mean, one of the first layers to that is just the mere fact that we care about important issues sets us apart from a lot of our culture. We often think, for example, that the only struggle is between those of us that are pro-life and those that are pro-abortion. In reality, the other whole group we're dealing with are those that just don't care enough to engage the issue at all, right? There was an article in the New York Times years ago talking about, there's so much conversations about whether you're an atheist or a theist, whether you believe in God or whether you don't believe in God. The author said, I'm an apatheist. I just don't care. And isn't that really one of the issues that we struggle with? You probably see it on the campus of a college or university the size of Grand Canyon. We certainly see it. I mean, you know, you guys that do policy all these times. One of the biggest issues is just getting Christians and getting people to care, right? And so I want to be clear on, you know, what on that point, because one of the best ways you can engage is just to care about issues that matter. There's a great quote from Vince Lombardi, the great football coach. He said, "I'm not afraid to lose. I'm afraid to win at something that doesn't matter." And I think that that's one of the first things, is care about things that matter. This is why the scriptures talk about us primarily not as believers, people who believe, but people who love. When you talk about love, you're talking about caring, and you're talking about passion, and you're talking about thinking about the best of other people. And so I think don't underestimate the power of just caring in a culture that is distracted to death, right? So that's number one. Number two is when you do get into this conversation with those who do actually care but are on the other side, I love their line from Father Sirico, who's the head of the Acton Institute in Grand Rapids. He said, "We have to be ruthless with ideas and gentle with people." And the reason that that's the case is, you've heard this phrase, it comes from a book by a guy named Richard Weaver, "Ideas have consequences," right? Here's the thing that should drive us. Yes, ideas have consequences, bad ideas have victims, right? So the thing that should drive us, Jesus said the greatest commandment is to love God, and then the second greatest commandment is to love your neighbor. If I really love my neighbor, I have to care not only about them, I have to care about the ideas that are in society that's victimizing them, lying to them, misleading them, you know, impacting the next generation. And that's the, and isn't that the story of the Good Samaritan? When Jesus is asked, okay, how do I love my neighbor? What Jesus tells is a story about the Samaritan, right? Somebody on the other side. Culturally, somebody on the other side of the audience, culturally, religiously, almost everything. And who are the two bad guys in that story? It's not the robber. It's the priest and the Levite who walks around the people, you know, the beaten, bloodied man and say, "Hey, come to church." Right? The hero of the story is the Samaritan who gets down and gets his hands bloody and muddy, like Jesus did, by the way, in God becoming flesh, taking on our sin and suffering, right? And so there's just that idea of engaging. So number one, just care. And number two, remember that when you engage, what you're dealing with are victims of bad ideas, not just the ideas. Does that make any sense? That's huge. And then the third thing I'll say is that you can develop skills. This is something that, you know, we sometimes forget. I don't know how to talk about those issues in public. Well, learn. I don't know the right arguments. Read a book. You know, I speak to a lot of students, and some students are like, "Oh, that's over my head." I'm like, "Yeah, you're too short. I don't have an attention span. Grow one." You know, in other words, we're not victims of our ignorance, and there really isn't an age of information. This is one of the things we talk about in the book, which you can pre-order on Amazon. Is that one of the things we talk about there is in an information. It's interesting. We have at our fingertips. There's more computing power in this than what sent a man to the moon. It's insane. I'm reading a book by Thomas Friedman on this right now. It will blow your mind. Here's the net result of that, is that this makes us apathetic. I don't have to learn anything. I can Google it. I don't have to actually think through it. And then T.S. Eliot years ago wrote about this. And of course, this is back in the 30s when he's writing this. In a play called The Rock, and it was a song in The Rock. He goes, "Where's all the not all the?" Let's see. Shoot, that would have been a good one if I could remember it. It goes something like this: "Where's all the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? Where's all the knowledge we have lost in information? Having more information than any other generation on the earth has not translated into having wisdom, and it makes us apathetic." And so, you see that the thing that I'm telling you is we need to engage culture, is the onus is on us, right? Number one, care about things that matter. Number two, realize that you're dealing not just with ideas, but the victims of those ideas. And the person across the aisle from you, on the other side of this issue, right? Are people themselves that are victims of bad ideas. They may be self-imposed victims, but they're still victims of bad ideas, and we need to find ways to love them and care for them. Because, again, the most true thing about them is they're made in the image and likeness of God. Their dignity is not acquired because they agree with us. Their dignity is inherent because of how God made them, and so we start there. And then third is get good at it. Learn skills. And I think Breakpoint can help with that, honestly, because every day on Breakpoint, we'll tackle an issue like doctor-assisted suicide, and then we'll end with, and what do you need to do about it? How can you use this? What can you say to your friends and neighbors? What's the question? We want Breakpoints to be repeatable and usable, right? Because we're just plagiarizing other people anyway, so you plagiarize us, and we'll all forgive each other, okay?
Well, and what you just said, I also heard when you spoke in January at the Evangelicals for Life conference, what you just said, you had the umbrella of civility.
Yeah.
And when we talk, you know, there's so much chatter out there about civil discourse and how we communicate. And that's the quote I had from you from then. You did a Sirico quote. With civility is realizing every single person is made in the image of God and worthy of redemption.